second case for oral arguments this morning is First State Bank of Roswell and others appellants versus Stanley E. Stabler and others appellees. For the appellants, we have Mr. Sander Moorhead, an attorney from Sioux Falls. And for the appellees, we have Mr. Lee Schoenbeck, an attorney from Watertown. The court had requested supplemental briefing on the 54B certification and wish to thank both counsel for supplying your views on that issue. And that is part of the argument this morning. With that, Mr. Moorhead, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
Honorable Chief Justice, may it please the court and counsel. Good morning. I'm here this morning on behalf of the appellants, First State Bank of Roscoe and John Byers. The issues before the court all arise from a summary judgment opinion order entered by the trial court on three issues, and I'll address those three issues in the order they were addressed by the trial court and by the parties in the briefing. The first issue relates to a $650,000 promissory note executed by all of the appellees, the Stablers, in favor of the First State Bank of Roscoe. The trial court improperly held that $650,000 note was an invalid reaffirmation agreement, therefore unenforceable. The second issue before the court relates to two mortgages, a 2000 mortgage and a 2002 collateral real estate mortgage. The trial court, we submit, erred in finding that the $650,000 note and related transaction operated to discharge those two mortgages and the obligations secured by them. And finally, and relatedly to the second issue, the third issue, we're here today to ask the court to reverse the trial court's decision, which we believe was improper, finding that the collateral real estate mortgage was invalid because there were six obligations secured, and the trial court found that there needed to be six different addendums filed as to that collateral real estate mortgage. Regarding the first issue before the court, the $650,000 note, the parties have submitted extensive briefing about cases from all over the country from a number of different bankruptcy courts and a variety of jurisdictions addressing whether or not an agreement such as this violates Section 524 of the Bankruptcy Code of Title 11. There's one case that the parties have cited that's actually a Circuit Court of Appeals opinion. That's from the Eighth Circuit. It's the Ford Motor Credit case. It's 276 Fed 3rd, 1019. And it's a case that we argued to the trial court. The trial court didn't address in its opinion invalidating the $650,000 transaction. We believe it's very applicable in this case. In that case, there was a pre-petition obligation, a lease between the debtors and Ford Motor Credit. And eventually the debtors filed for bankruptcy, and yet they continued to make payments and continued to hang on to the leased vehicle. And the Eighth Circuit noted, if that hadn't been the case, there's no doubt the Ford Motor Credit could have repossessed the vehicle back. Instead, they kept making their payments, and eventually, after bankruptcy, came to Ford Motor Credit again and said, we want a new deal, we want another vehicle, we want to continue having a borrower-lender relationship with you. And Ford Motor Credit said, that's fine, but you've racked up quite a bit of additional mileage and wear and tear charges related to that pre-petition obligation. We want you to make good on that as a precondition of being able to get additional credit from us. And the debtors agreed, and they went on and made payments for a couple of years, and eventually, for whatever reason, decided they didn't like that deal anymore and reopened their bankruptcy case and asked the court to declare that it was an invalid reaffirmation agreement. They said, well, this was a pre-petition obligation, and by making us pay this debt related to a pre-petition obligation, you essentially made us reaffirm discharge debt. And the Eighth Circuit focused on one important thing in this case, and that was the absence of any coercion. The Eighth Circuit said, there isn't any evidence, well, first, the Eighth Circuit noted, there wasn't any obligation on the part of Ford Motor Credit to continue doing business with them. They could have looked at the debtors and said, you just went through bankruptcy, we're concerned about your creditworthiness, we're not going to loan you any more money. They also noted that an absence of coercion and focused on the presence or absence of that and said, in that particular case, this was a voluntary decision by the debtors to enter into this transaction, and citing 524 of the Bankruptcy Code said it's not an invalid reaffirmation agreement, it's a valid post-petition transaction. In this case, we've got similar facts, albeit it's not a lease, but we still have a pre-petition obligation. We have these obligations that the Stablers, and I think the parties have agreed, were these secured obligations secured by two mortgages that after the bankruptcy had been filed by the Stablers, they continued to make payments on and eventually came to the First State Bank of Roscoe and said, we want to continue doing business with you. We want to continue to maintain possession of our collateral. We want to continue moving forward. The bank said, we want to work with you as well. But the quid pro quo for that was agreeing to pay on those $650,000 of obligations. There isn't any allegation, there isn't any discussion or analysis from the trial court about the presence or absence of coercion on that issue, or whether or not it was a voluntary act by the debtors in doing that. And that's where we believe the trial court went wrong. The court should have looked at that and realized that that was an important issue of fact that made this issue improper for summary judgment.
Can I interrupt you? I'd like to go back to the 54B.
Sure. Issue.
Which for me is kind of the elephant in the room here, is whether we should be hearing this case at this point. Because it seems to me that if we go ahead and rule on these various transactions and these issues, you're going to have to go back and have a trial on the tort actions and the counterclaims on the very same transactions, the very same mortgages and security agreements. And so I'm real concerned here that we're going to piecemeal this case rather than deciding it after everything has been adjudicated. And I'm also concerned, I realize you're asking more than one question, but and that is that you've got discovery that you want to do on some various issues, and that has, I don't see you appealing that. I don't know if that's still pending or what, but so I'm real concerned here that maybe this is premature for us to be taking this complex case on at this point. Can you address that?
Yes, Your Honor. I'll try to cover both of the points. First, in the party submissions of the court, I think both parties or all of the parties agree that this first particular issue I'm addressing, the validity or invalidity of this $650,000 note, is probably the single most important, and it's really the issue in the case that's driving the case. You mentioned other tort claims. The plaintiffs, the Stablers' other tort claims in the case, primarily, I'm not going to say all of them, but primarily, are based on the allegation that there's a breach of fiduciary duty because of this transaction, there's fraud because of this transaction, and so forth. They all look back to that $650,000 transaction and the propriety or impropriety of that transaction of the bankruptcy code as the basis of those causes of action. There are a couple of other unrelated causes of action, one for declaratory relief, which is the subject of the third issue, the validity of the collateral real estate mortgage. And there's a separate fraud count related to, it's actually a fraud, the inducement type claim regarding one of the mortgages. Those are off to the side, but all of the other tort claims in the case are highly, highly related to how this first issue gets resolved. Regarding the...
So let me stop you right there, because if a jury would say that fraud vitiates the bank's claims, then we wouldn't have to decide the commercial law question.
Actually, Your Honor, and counsel will correct me if I'm wrong, the breach of fiduciary duty claim, for instance, is essentially you breached your fiduciary duty by convincing these people to enter into an agreement that was an invalid reaffirmation agreement. Same way with the fraud claim, same way with the duty of good faith and fair dealing claim. Those claims all relate back to the $650,000 transaction, whether it's valid. The separate fraud claim that I mentioned relates just to one mortgage. It doesn't relate to all of the other transactions at issue in the case. So even if the jury would agree on that unrelated tort claim, it would not upset the decision. In fact, because it's unrelated to this transaction, wouldn't be affected one way or another by the decision of this court.
If we say that the $650,000 transaction is invalid, there's still going to be a tort trial on that same issue, isn't there? On whether or not the bank committed a tort. If we say it's valid, there's still going to be a tort trial on the same transaction, isn't there?
I would disagree with you, Your Honor. I'll take it from two different directions. First, if you find that it's valid, a valid transaction, at least as to the claims that are based and have their focus, that allegation, the propriety or impropriety of the $650,000 transaction, we would submit that at that point those issues would be ripe for summary judgment, because at that point there isn't anything left supporting those claims. And on the other hand, if you rule that it is improper, we still believe there's a possibility that those could be resolved as a matter of law at the trial court as well. Regarding the second part of your question, Justice, about the discovery issue, that is an important issue, and it relates to the merits of the case as well. One of the issues that the court raised in its letter was, well, address this discovery issue. We are appealing the court's decision on the discovery issue in the sense that we filed a 56F motion stating there are these issues of intent in this case. There's this issue of whether or not this was a voluntary act. There's these issues about why the debtors did or didn't engage in these transactions. We should be entitled to depose the Stablers, depose their attorney, who they pointed out as not acting in their best interest in the case, get an opportunity to get full discovery from all of those parties and know all the facts before there was a ruling, and instead the trial court said, I don't believe that any additional discovery is going to be relevant to the issues before the court, and denied that motion in a footnote in his opinion. And that speaks then to the last question, the possibility that we'd be here again on this issue.
Well, so let me stop before you go to that, because if we don't have the full discovery on the party's intent and this coercion argument isn't improper, I mean, it's not improper, but the case isn't in a very good posture for us to decide without that information.
Well, the catch-22 that my client's in, Your Honor, is what part of our appeal is summary judgment shouldn't have been granted because we need to do this additional discovery. And so that's why we're here appealing, in part, that the summary judgment shouldn't have been granted so that we can finish the discovery. If the court rules there's no jurisdiction over that, that's problematic, because then the court doesn't get to reach the issue of, well, should the court have granted the 56F motion and allowed the discovery to continue?
Why can't we send it back with directions to finish discovery? Then we'll look at it.
If the court wants to do that, and that's something that we encourage the court to do in our letter submission to the court, I believe this court does have the power and certainly the authority to look at its own jurisdiction and say, because we've got a concern about discovery, we want discovery to be completely finished before further dispositive motions. So we're remanding this with instructions to vacate, or vacating and remanding this pending the completion of discovery, and then the parties can re-tee up, so to speak, the motions that they want to bring.
But in your letter brief, you seem to make a distinction between us retaining jurisdiction and sending it back rather than dismissing it. I'm not sure I understand why you take that position rather than what we've done in Davis and Wisner and the other cases, is simply just to dismiss the appeal.
The reason the word retain was used was because of the concern that I mentioned earlier, that the court would say, well, we can't take jurisdiction of this to resolve the 56F issue, whether or not discovery should have been permitted. And so that was the reason we urged the court to retain jurisdiction, at least for the limited purpose of saying we feel it was inappropriate for summary judgment to be entered at this time. We want a remand so that the parties can finish all their discovery and then have dispositive motions hearings proceed from there. But to dovetail back to the previous conversation, it's certainly within the court's authority to simply say we don't believe we have jurisdiction until discovery is completed and we direct the trial court to take up these issues again once that's taken place.
Mr. Moorhead, some of the, I believe both of the responses from you and Mr. Schoenbeck talked about setoffs and indicating that there was a possible issue of setoffs. How would that not be at odds with 54B that there was a that this should be a final ruling if there are issues of setoff that are still pending?
The issues of setoff that I was referring to in our submission related to the court's first summary judgment decision back in May of 2009. The parties, the First State Bank of Roscoe and John Byers, on that motion had raised a number of summary judgment issues that were unrelated to the $650,000 transaction and unrelated to the issue of whether or not debt was or was not discharged in bankruptcy. In fact, they were all debts, mortgages, and security interest counts that the First State Bank or John Byers had brought as almost prophylactically in case they were construed to be compulsory counterclaims. They were all on debts, mortgages, and notes that weren't really in dispute.
Isn't there an issue of whether or not that was a final order and certified under 54?
Well, that's one thing that the parties have apparently disputed about in this case. We've cited the portions of the transcript from the court and from both statements made by court and counsel to the effect that the intent of this appeal was supposed to be take up both sets of summary judgment decisions all up on appeal, and whoever wanted to appeal those issues could. And we've cited to the case law in our supplemental submission to the effect that even if something isn't perfectly stated in the written order, as long as the court makes it clear in the record somewhere that it intends everything to be certified, they can all be certified for purposes of appeal. I don't know for sure why now the Stablers are claiming that that first summary judgment decision shouldn't be construed as having been certified as final and shouldn't be up here on appeal if they want to appeal anything from that. I don't know, and I'm even more mystified at the contention that John Byers or the bank are the ones now that want to be able to appeal that decision because John Byers and the bank won on every issue on the first summary judgment decision. So I don't know what the reason is for that. But I agree there's a dispute between the parties. We believe that the record supports that the trial court clearly told everybody now is the time for all of my summary judgment decisions today to be appealed.
Now that's a little unclear, but what is clear, I guess, is the court's stated reason for the second summary judgment motion. And the court's only articulated reason for granting the certification was the decision addresses important financial matters of the parties and disposes of significant legal issues affecting the rights between the parties. Well, we previously said the court has to go through the analysis the various factors, and it doesn't appear that was done. This type of reasoning has been rejected as insufficient. I know now you've argued the factors, but the court never did that. So doesn't that also say that, I mean, under our law, that we should not take this appeal at this point?
Your Honor, two responses. Number one is that the parties, I think, have thoroughly addressed it and have met it. Number two, if the court believes that there's an issue in that regard, just as I believe the court has the authority to say, we're sending this back, we're not going to rule on this now, we want you to vacate or otherwise reconsider your decisions to date once discovery is fully completed. I also believe And we would argue that the court has the authority and ability to remand this on a limited basis to the trial court if it's got concerns and say, Judge, would you please address each of the factors in Davis in an additional memorandum opinion? And then that can come back up here and the court can decide if that's sufficient rather than simply dismissing the appeal. With the brief time I have here on the other two issues, regarding the validity of the two mortgages at issue, we believe that we briefed and pointed out that ordinarily the presumption is when there's a refinance or a substitution of a new note for pre-existing debt, ordinarily the presumption is the mortgage continues, the lien continues, and because the debt isn't paid, because the notes aren't what's secured, it's actually the debt that's secured. And we believe that in this case there wasn't any indication of intent by the parties to discharge the mortgages or to discharge the debt. My time
Thank
is
you, up. Mr. Morehead. The court failed to note before we started that Justice Wilbur has disqualified herself, and the court has appointed the Honorable Robert A. Miller, former justice of this court, to sit in Justice Wilbur's place. With that, Mr. Schoenbeck, you have 20 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Justices, clerk of the court,
Walker,
and counsel, it is always an honor to be here before you. And I find myself looking at that elephant in the room that's been referred to. When the order to show cause came, I read that and I said, I guess we're not going to appear on Tuesday until the clerk of the court informed me that, no, yes, you still will be here. They want to talk to you in person about that. I thought it looked pretty foreboding when I read it, and I shared the same with counsel. And I'm in a little bit different position here because I want to be here defending that this court, I mean, I understand I'm the appellee, but we want this court to take this appeal. And if I could just go through some of the questions that you've raised, you know, the trial court here took up what are not normal issues, to many of them bankruptcy related, to appear in a state trial court in South Dakota, and issued a very detailed and well-reasoned decision. And the trial court, as each one of the members of this court have been in those shoes, said, you know, I'd like the Supreme Court to take this up. And you're right.
But you know, I got to stop you right there, Mr. Schoenbeck, because, I mean, you know that's not a good enough reason.
I
mean, as trial judges, we complicated cases, you get halfway through, and you go, boy, I wish I knew for sure on this one, because we're going to be wasting a lot of time if we didn't know how this is going to come. But courts looking at 54B have never allowed that kind of thinking to prevail to justify 54B certification.
I raised that discussion before the trial court, and the trial court was of the opinion, but the exact same rationale, Justice Zinter, that you just described is what the trial court went through, or anguish, and said that, you know what, if both parties agree, because I raised Davis in the oral argument there, and said if both parties agree, usually the Supreme Court is willing to accept the 54B certification from a trial judge. That may or may not be a correct statement of law, but I'm just the lawyer, and I'm here as an appellee. But I will say that what is true about this appeal is that there is no discovery to do on these issues. These are not fact-based issues. Judge Myron issued rulings on three distinct issues of law that will not be affected by any discovery or anything else that happens in the case, other than there would still be a trial, and I think the issue has been raised that, I mean, there will be a trial. No matter how this court rules, there would be a trial. And a jury could decide that even in spite of bad conduct by the bank, that to not hold them accountable. So in that sense, it could, but it would be, the legal issues are likely.
Let me ask you, what damage, harm, prejudice would you see if this court would find the 54B appropriate and send it back to the trial court and say, keep going? Where's the harm?
It would only be in terms of, and if I go back to Justice Zinter's comments, which are as I think you've all been there. The only issue would be this. As a trial judge, you know that you had to make some rulings that have not, that there's not a lot of guidance on, or not as good a guidance as you'd like, and it's only the concern about what was I right or wrong.
Okay, so you...
It's a judicial economy issue.
You perceive him looking for an advisory opinion from this court, then?
And I'll never say those words, Justice
Miller. I know you would, but I'm asking you if you think...
Some might say it looks like that.
Okay. Fair
enough. But in fairness, these are unique legal issues. They're not issues of fact.
Well, let me stop you on that, because we've got the coercion elephant out there. I know there's a disagreement about whether that's in play or not. But also, we've got this refinancing versus, help me.
Renewal.
And there's some fact, it seems to me, in that question as well.
If I might take that issue first, Justice. That action, and I'll be frank, that's the weaker of the two positions we have in support of issue number two. The better issue that removes any discussion about renewal versus refinancing is this. The parties contracted about what mortgages were going to be transferred. It's Appellee's Appendix 1, and it's 51 and 53, I believe, are the numbers. Excuse me, 41 and 43. They actually signed a contract and said one mortgage would go with this note. And that issue was raised in the appeal by the bank, but not discussed. It was completely waived in their brief. They didn't talk about the fact there's a contract here. And so issues of intent about was it a refinance or renewal, those are really not an issue. The issue is, and that's what the trial court looked at, said there's a contract between the parties. And in appellant's own brief, they cite to the Smith case. It's on pages 11 and 12. It's an indented direct quote. And in that authority, it says the language, the law they like is in there, and at the end of it says, unless the parties contract or do otherwise by agreement, which is in fact what happened here.
If I understand you correctly, your argument, you're saying that these summary judgment motions are so fundamental or essential to the remaining claims that unless they're resolved here by this court at this time, it would be very difficult or maybe impossible to go forward on the remaining claims. Is that what you're trying to tell us?
I'm a better lawyer than that. Whatever rules you guys make, I'll try my case under, and same with Judge Myron. The fact is, we'll still try the case no matter what. I mean, if the court says, what we'll do is we'll try it with the rulings that the court has made.
How does this necessity argument square with our 54B standard review?
I'm the appellee. I fully understand that, and in fact, I tried to be quite frank in the letter brief and answer the court's questions. I mean, there are issues of set-offs. We're still going to try the issues. They're related issues. But these three issues are unique legal issues that will not be revisited. And if I might, with respect to 54B, I did want to mention this. The appellant's docketing statement, they only said they were appealing the document that had the ruling had a 54B certification. In fact, they checked that they had a 54B certification. There is no 54B certification for the May 2009 ruling, and we couldn't file a notice of review because you can't fill out a docketing statement and claim that there's a 54B certification for that when there isn't one. I would have had to lie in my statement. They did not raise the 2009 summary judgment decision in their notice of review. So I think the court's already there based on the language in the order to show cause, but I wanted to make sure you understood our problem with it is we couldn't appeal it because it didn't have a 54B certification.
Mr. Schoenbeck, if I read your amended complaint correctly, a jury could basically nullify all the debts at issue in the three arguments that we have before us today on claims in your untoward claims that you raise, independent of the contract or commercial law basis upon which Judge Myron ruled. Is that correct?
Maybe. There are so many mortgages that this bank did floated around that's almost hard to sort out. They clearly can do it based on Judge Myron's rulings.
But your complaint Your complaint seeks to void everything, as I read it.
Actually, not everything. There is some money that was borrowed by Brad and Brenda Stabler that we don't dispute, and there's some money that Stan and Rose Stabler borrowed that we don't dispute. It's all of the discharge debt that was dumped onto the deal. That
is the stuff that you don't dispute. Is that the stuff that's the subject of the 2009 ruling?
A little bit of the Brad and Brenda debt might be in there, but part of what's in that 2009 ruling is discharge debt also. What they did is they went and rolled it out of the bank before the bank examiners came, and Judge Myron, if you look at the footnote in his ruling that is before this court on appeal, he said, you know, I know more now than I knew then, and I reserve the right to be smarter now, and if I was wrong then, there's going to be another motion for summary judgment to revisit the 2009 in light of what the court knows now. But that one does have a number of factual issues related with respect to intent. Now, these three issues are straight questions of law. I'm not sure if I answered the court's question.
Well, the question is, is it possible the tort claims could make these three issues go away? Not go away, but not have to be decided.
And no, because if the tort issues end up that way, it's going to get appealed, and the question is going to be the firmity or infirmity of any verdict, because it's going to be based on these rulings. I think it's inevitable these issues will be before the court one day or the other, because if you try and take discharge debt and con somebody into paying it, eventually this court's going to have that issue. It's fundamental to the case, no matter how the jury ultimately goes. If I might discuss the three issues, although it's pretty clear from the last 20 minutes that that's not the primary focus of today's oral arguments, but if I might briefly, the reaffirmation, Judge Myron went with what is far and away the majority perspective, which is that you have to follow 524C of the Bankruptcy Code on reaffirmation, that everybody, I think, generally in the bar understands what a reaffirmation is. The only case, there are no modern cases in the last 15 years that take the bank's position. In fact, we put that in our brief. We shepherdized them, and you notice that they didn't come up with any, save one. For the first time, they raised the voluntary payment issue, 524F. If you look in their appellant's brief, you'll see that legal authority is not contained in the list of authorities cited. The statute isn't, nor is the DuBois case, the Ford Motor case, not contained there. First raised not in their reply brief. And the reason why DuBois doesn't fit, and this court didn't get to have a brief because it didn't come up until the reply, is that DuBois is not a 524C, which I love. I always hate that bankruptcy lawyers. They talk a language that normal people can't even understand, myself included. But 524C reaffirmation is not an issue when you have a lease case. The DuBois case is a lease case. There you have to go to 11 U.S.C. 365P2, which has a whole separate procedure that why you don't have to do a reaffirmation agreement, and then you can make voluntary payments under 524F, and that's the only authority they found. In the DuBois case, the debtors were alleging violation of the automatic stay. In the DuBois case, Ford Motor was not trying to sue the DuBois to collect discharge debt. That wasn't what was going on, which is our case. If what they say for a lease, which is really a 365P2 case, if that were true, it would just completely gut the reaffirmation standards and provisions in the code, and that's why all the modern cases that we set out at length for you say, no, that's not the law. You have to follow the reaffirmation rules. Second issue, which has to do with the effect of on the 2000 and 2002 mortgages of the 2004, when the bank sold the mortgage to two investors. At that time, they signed a contract. It's Appendix 1, App Documents 41 and 43. And those documents specifically identify that the only mortgage that will be transferred is the 2004 one. At that point, the bank was paid in full. There was no debt that existed at the bank. They were paid in full, and they agreed, and all the parties, the Stablers included, signed that agreement that only the 2004 mortgage would transfer. So Judge Myron said, your old mortgages didn't exist once you were paid in full and you contractually agreed to just transfer the 2004 mortgage. And in their brief, the bank has refused to discuss the issue in the appeal, raised by their appeal, which is that that they contractually agreed, all the parties, that only one mortgage would transfer. The last issue...
A related question on that. I haven't been able to sort out for sure. Was there new money injected? Was there $650,000 in new money injected by the insurers on this March 9th transaction?
According to the record, yes. The insurers paid the bank, so the bank got the debt, much like the 2009 transaction, out of the bank, off the books, to Schurer and Ernst. And then, it's in the record, and then a little while later, Mr. Byers, who is subject of another appeal before this court, Mr. Byers then personally buys the note back, and then he tries to go back and get the mortgages that were gone because when the debt was paid. He tries to take the 2000 and 2002 mortgages and get the bank to satisfy them back to him so that he can resurrect old mortgages because he got problems with some of his collateral issues, and he's got this bankruptcy discharge debt that he's loaded into this transaction. And so the bankruptcy discharge is a critical part of the issues. On the third issue on collateral real estate mortgages, the judge just read the statute and applied it. And the legislature changed the law later. The current statute would do what the bank wants it to be, where you would just do one extension. But that wasn't the case before. Before, there were two classes. If you put multiple notes, and then you had to look if they... you got 6 months from the date if they were less than 5 years, and you had to file your amendment. I'm not a debtor creditor guy, but Pat Doherty went to Florida and left me here, by the way. I'd have him take the last 2 minutes and explain to you how CREMs work. But the amendment that you file, you have 6 months after the due date if it's less than 5 years. That's what the statute said. Or 6 months after, if it's 5 years, you got 5 years plus 6 months. The legislature changed it, so you just need one amendment now to extend one extension. But this court recognized in the Dugard decision that just handed down that when the law changes, it's because it meant something before, and you change it to make it mean something new. Well, that's exactly what Judge Myron said in his analysis of 44-8-26, that the law as it was is what he had to apply. The bank doesn't like the law as it was. The bank would like the law as it is, and that's not the case when these events arose. Those are the three substantive issues, and I noticed that you took almost no notes when we discussed those three issues, and more notes in discussion on the order to show cause, which sort of gets back to that elephant in the room analogy. And I would just say that...
But you put more writing in your briefs on the main issues, so we didn't need to take as many notes.
Thank you, Chief. I would just say that I think Judge Myron is very sincere, and these are distinct legal issues for which no new discovery is required. When he said, "Please decide if I'm right or wrong on this," because it's a judicial economy issue, it's a very large piece of commercial litigation, and these are very fundamental to the case. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Schoenbeck. Mr. Moorhead, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Schoenbeck left off with the 54B issue, but I do want to address a few of the substantive points that he made in the second half. Mr. Schoenbeck claims that these three issues before the court...
I take it you find little fault with his 54B analysis.
Pardon?
I take it you find little fault with his 54B analysis.
Find little fault?
Yes.
In terms of what the court has conveyed by way of its thoughts and his responses, I don't disagree that the issues here are important issues, and I do believe that the court, as much as articulated in the manner in which it certified it by saying these are important issues, and that it was sending the signal that it wants to know what these issues mean and how they need to be resolved.
Do you agree with his statement that no more discovery is necessary?
I disagree, and that actually goes to the substance of my argument as well. Again, we had a 54F motion that we made, and it was denied. Mr. Schoenbeck now today has said these are three straight-out issues of law that aren't going to require any additional discovery. As to the first issue, briefly, Mr. Schoenbeck discussed 365, the assume and reject provisions of the bankruptcy code. Notably, in the Ford Motor Credit case, that wasn't the basis of the Eighth Circuit's decision. The Eighth Circuit didn't talk about, well, this is a different case because this is an assumption or rejection case. The Eighth Circuit said, you came in and you wanted additional credit, and there's no evidence that you're coerced into this, and so without more, I'm going to grant a motion to dismiss in favor of the creditor. Now, here we've heard counsel today throw around a lot of words like conned, tricked, moving things around, and that's their allegation and that's their case. But the point of our 54F motion is we're entitled to depose the Stablers and find out what their intent was and their understanding, and to depose their bankruptcy lawyer, who we believe discovery will show was the one who actually said this is the way these things should be structured, which could give rise to an estoppel defense on our part as well. And so to simply say no more discovery is necessary, well, if I were in their position, I wouldn't want any more discovery to be done either. The Stablers haven't been deposed yet. Their lawyer, who they've accused of wrongdoing, hasn't been deposed yet, so he gets an opportunity to speak his piece and defend himself. And so that was the reason for our 54F motion. That was the reason we said, on, especially as to this first issue, where there's case law out there that talks about the presence or absence of voluntariness under 524 of the Bankruptcy Code, we shouldn't decide that issue yet. Now, with regard to the discharge of mortgage issue, the second issue, I don't see how we've possibly waived that argument at all. The Stablers made the argument in their response that, well, because there was an agreement to transfer a loan, and it only mentioned one of the mortgages that secured the debt that was ultimately transferred, that operated to preclude transfer of the other two mortgages. But in fact, in our reply brief, we did raise, and in our opening brief, we raised SDCL 44-8-1.4, which is a codification of about 100 years of Supreme Court precedent that says, if you transfer secured debt, the security follows the debt. If person A and person B have an agreement between each other, and person B is borrowing money from person A and it's secured by a mortgage, if that debt gets assigned to a third party, regardless of whether there's an assignment of mortgage executed at all, the security follows the note. One of the cases that we cite in the brief, the Ainsworth case, the party resisting enforcement of that principle said there isn't even any allegation that there was an assignment of the mortgage executed. And this court said it doesn't matter because it follows by operation of law. And so there is a significant issue of intent because the bank and buyers put forth affidavit evidence that it was the intent of the parties to transfer or assign these obligations to the SURES and then to buyers, which by operation of law would have transferred the mortgages, which I don't think there's any dispute, secured the debt that was part of the 650. That would then follow the debt irrespective of whether a formal assignment was executed or not. In fact, even Brenda Stabler, two of the parties to these transactions, maintained that the debt that was in the $650,000 obligation and then transferred to SURES and then transferred to buyers was that same debt. And the trial court disregarded that and said, you can't rely on statements made by other parties in their summary judgment pleadings. Because with Stan and Rose Stabler's motion, we couldn't rely on the admissions and concessions that Brad and Brenda Stabler had made in their motion. Finally, regarding the collateral real estate mortgage issue, we disagree with the court's analysis on two different grounds. The first is this court hasn't interpreted the collateral real estate mortgage previously and what the policy was. The North Dakota Supreme Court has interpreted an identical statute, or it was identical at the time, noted that the purpose of collateral real estate mortgages is kind of a benefit to both sides of the transaction. It's supposed to give flexibility to both borrowers and lenders in their relationship. And one important thing is that the lender can have one mortgage and only have one instrument securing various obligations. Under Justice Myron's reading of the collateral real estate mortgage statute, if you have a collateral real estate mortgage securing multiple obligations, you run, as is the case here, the need to file multiple different addendums. That seems to run contrary to the notion of a simple one mortgage, one instrument policy behind the collateral real estate mortgage statute. Second of all, the purpose of filing an addendum with the Register of Deeds is notice to third parties. Well, the First State Bank of Roskill filed an addendum in this case, and that did give notice to third parties, and there's no evidence any third party did anything in this case in reliance on whether or not addendums were filed on the other note, as to the other notes. Finally, Your Honor, on that, there is an obligation that's more than 5 years, was going to be more than 5 years in the future. 2013 is the actual maturity date. We believe that filing an addendum within the five-year period met the statute. Related to the third party and notice the third party's issue, there was another issue that we raised below that the trial court didn't address, and that's the notion of the potential for an equitable lien that would arise. The North Dakota Supreme Court addressing collateral real estate mortgages said if a, and this is in the Gust case that we cited, said in the event that a collateral real estate mortgage lapses because of the failure to file a timely addendum, the court can still imply an equitable lien so as to prevent unjust enrichment on the part of the debtor. And another case cited by Seduce.
The circuit court hasn't ruled on that yet.
The circuit court, when Stan and Rose Stabler filed their motion for summary judgment, alleging and asking the court to rule as a matter of law that the collateral real estate mortgage was invalid, we raised as an issue, as to the validity, the issue of whether or not there could be an equitable lien. And we pointed to, and I can point to the portions of the record, but we even argued that at oral argument before the court. And it just, the reason it appears that he didn't rule on that is because the issue just isn't addressed in his opinion. And we noted that in our briefing as well, that here's another reason why it's premature to grant summary judgment on that third issue, because we've got this equitable lien idea out there that hasn't even been addressed by the trial court. Now,
your answer or counterclaim?
Pardon?
Your answer or counterclaim, I can't remember which, talks also about equitable subrogation. Is that something different than equitable lien?
They're similar concepts, and I think they share the same idea, and I think we're probably talking about the same thing. It's the idea that John Byers steps into the shoes of the previous lien holders. But it's borrowing from the discussion I had earlier about the statute in Chapter 44.1 that says the mortgage follows the debt. And it's also the notion that even if you find a mortgage is for one reason or other invalid, this court's recognized since as early as 1924 that you can possibly have an equitable lien. And that's in the Savings Bank of Hartford v. Munt case. It's 197 Northwest 156. It's different facts, but it was just recognizing the possibility of an equitable lien. My time's expired.
It is.
Thank you very much.
Court will be in recess until tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock.